It's a pleasure to welcome Professor Amitai Etzioni to give this public lecture on morality in a free society. Professor Etzioni has had a very distinguished academic career, shortly to be crowned by the award of the prize by the Simon Wiesenthal Center for his book. The prize is called the Bruno Brand Tolerance Award by the Simon Wiesenthal Center for his book, published earlier this year, The New Golden Rule. He is professor of sociology at the George Washington University, but is more than the average academic. He is a mover and a shaker. He is the founder and director of the Communitarian Network, which has an active program of shoring up the moral, social, and political environment in America on a non-sectarian, non-partisan, nationwide basis. He is also the founder and the first president of the International Society for the Advancement of Socioeconomics. We're very proud to have him as a visiting professor at LSE at the moment and to invite him to give this public lecture on morality in a free society. Professor Etzioni.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Very privileged to be here at what is clearly an historical moment, where the eyes are on what's going to happen here over the next years by all democratic societies who are struggling with the question how we can find new directions and new ways which don't assume that the market can solve most of our social problems, but at the same time realize that big government cannot neither provide all that needs to be done, and we are looking for new ways, which I'm sure we hear much more about them in the next years. You'll notice, those of you who I've been inflicted upon in the past, that I'll talk with more reluctance than usual, because the ideas I'm going to share with you tonight are new to me. And I need your indulgence. Actually, more than that, I need your participation. I'm here hoping that at least some of you be sufficiently intrigued with this challenge to join us in trying to develop this rather a new approach. Now, I've been doing communitarian things for the last 5 years. 6 years. I spent most of them with politicians and in churches and labor unions, basically, preaching. And it was not a complete failure. We had a certain amount of following. The reason was not that we had such a brilliant message. The reason, I believe firmly, is because we had a message whose time has come. And we suddenly noticed about a year and a half, 2 years ago, that while fellow citizens and politicians of very different backgrounds found a lot of interest in the communitarian thinking, that one group was left behind and was less than convinced, and these were my colleagues on the campus. So I decided to return to my roots and spend ever more time over the last years making the case for communitarian thinking, not the way it's done in the spirit of community, which after all is a pamphlet, has a cartoon on the first page, just to make it clear, but to make academic case in the way it's done in traditional scholarship. And the new golden rule is my attempt to address my colleagues about these issues, and today be my first public lecture trying to make the academic case, the scholarly case, for communitarian thinking. Now, in fair warning, I won't be able to completely resist my last past years, and toward the end I'll give some unasked for advice to Tony Blair. But let me first make the academic case. And the central thesis of communitarian thinking, as I see it, is to argue that a society requires a carefully crafted balance between liberty and the common good. It requires a carefully balance between liberty and the common good. Liberty has many definitions, but they all come down to a surprisingly simple sentence, and that is the desire or the right of the person to be left alone. There are other formulations of it. People should be able to make their own choices. People should be protected from the government by a thick layer of rights. People should be free agent. People should have to voluntarily consent to the social order. But behind all this is basically the notion that people should make their own formulation of the social good. The notion of social order, or the notion of common good, in many ways, in effect, is diametrically opposed to the idea of liberty. The idea of the common good is that society, the community, from its religious roots or other ethical, philosophical, cultural origins, has decided collectively what the common good is. It has been socially formulated, and it seeks to foster, encourage, or force individuals to abide by the shared definition of the common good. So, for instance, if we decided as a society that we need to protect the environment, we suddenly tell individuals, no, you cannot do that. You cannot dump this into the river. You have to recycle. And we curb their choices in the name of a higher good. Just to mention the nature of these two concepts, you see why there is a built-in tension between them, tension which inevitable cannot be reduced. Now, what happened, as I see it, is over the years or the centuries, two public philosophies have been developed. Public philosophies are philosophies which have a sociological significance beyond academia, which play a role in the body society, but have their origins in philosophical writing, which each take one half of the elephant and make that their case, that they argue for maximizing or privileging that part of the story they find compelling. Now, to make this point and document it, which is essential for what I'd like to share with you tonight, I need to do something which you don't get any points. And that is, I have to rearrange the intellectual, political, moral map, the way we usually think about that. The reason is because traditionally we think about this issue in terms of the private sector as against the government. So then we have the conservatives against the liberals or left here, but differences between the countries. They are celebrating the private sector, the market. This used to be at least thinking that the state could be a much more effective tool of our social purposes. This is the debate which has been with us at least for a century and a half, with the Fabians and Marx and so on and so on. What I want to talk about tonight is call attention to a rather different divide, because I'm not so much concerned with the economy. I'm concerned with the body society. I'm concerned with the family, with schools, with neighborhoods, the social fabric. And there, the main camps are lined up differently. If you have on the one side the camp, I'm going to be called the individualist. And the individualists include the classical liberals, John Locke, something people call the contemporary classical liberals, kind of odd phrase, like John Rawls and maybe Dworkin. They include our civil libertarians, like the American the ACLU. They include the other libertarians, like Nozick, at least in his book, and the laissez-faire conservatives. So the group which is usually put in opposition, I put over here, because they share with all these other people one essential characteristic. They see the individual as a free agent, the center of their universe. But who's left on the other side? I learned in this week and a half of being here that this other group is not so much in your mind, because you are one of the few places in the world which has been spared so far, at least the full force of what I'm going to call the social conservatives. But the social conservatives' defining characteristic is precisely that they know what is good, and they want to make of members of society heed their collective definition. The most important group which represents that kind of thinking are the religious fundamentalists. And while they're here, and I understand sometimes some of you find them irksome, they're not a major political force in Britain, and they don't get your attention nearly as much as Pat Robertson and his 40 million followers get our attention in the United States, playing a major role in the Republican Party. They are, of course, a major force in Islam, ranging from Indonesia into Turkey, into the Middle East, into Algeria. And there are Jewish fundamentalists. Well, they're just 20%. They hold the peace hostage in Israel. They're a major, major social force. Now, given these two camps, just to be absolutely sure before I move on that we understand each other about this vital difference, if you bear with me for a moment, I'll find the essential quotes to give the feeling for what it's all about. When we talk about, for the last time, the individualists, here is what Ronald Dworkin defines liberalism as: the conviction, quote, that political decisions must be, so far as possible, independent from any particular conception of the good life or what gives value to life. And John Rawls writes at one point, I said it liberally at one point because he changes sometimes, individuals find their good in different ways, and many things may be good for one person that would not be good for another. In a well-ordered society, then, plans of life of individuals are different in the sense that these plans give prominence to different aims, and persons are left free to determine their good. I couldn't give you a better definition of the individualistic camp. Now, what does the other group say? Robert Beiner writes, conservatism has a theory of social and political order. Conservatives have often distinguished their own beliefs as committed in order in preference to other values such as progress, equality, or liberty. And Rodney Baker writes, the central purpose of a society, understood as a moral community, is not the maximization of autonomy or the protection of the broader scope for design of self-elected plans of life, but the cultivation of virtue. These are the two camps which by far dominate our thinking. Now, let me be fair and say that each group will make some concession to the other side. So, for instance, the more moderate individualist will recognize, let's say, they're very influential in neoclassical economics, that there are some things like public goods which the market will not provide. And libertarians, especially the more reasonable libertarians, will say that, of course, they realize that there is a need for law, and you can't just only rely on individuals following their own individual plans. But the underlying principle is that these are exceptions to the rule, that we seek to maximize liberty here, and then, if all else fails, claims against the maximization of liberty have to submit to something the lawyers call the high scrutiny. It means they have to jump through three hoops. They have to prove their case before they can lay gloves on the value which is maximized here. When you go to the other side, well, one of the more moderate social conservatives, Alistair MacIntyre, and that's a direct quote, says that human rights are fictions. They're like unicorns, something we imagine. Now, push comes to shove. Actually, they don't like to talk about liberty at all. But they will recognize, for instance, Father Richard Newhouse says, that people are free to choose as long as they choose what's right. And so you see now why I find it useful to sketch these camps. And as I'm leaving them now, let me say in all fairness, those of you who are following these things scholarly, we could spend 2 years examining each one of these theses, and we will find enormous differences. As you all know, Adam Smith's one book is different from the other. John Stuart Mill in the same book changes his position. So I cannot, and it's not my purpose here, to go in all the nuances. But it's important for us to realize the tendency to maximize these two camps. Now, my number one thesis is that while ideologically it's very attractive, it makes for good copy, for good arguments, to call for one of the two camps, that a good society, a well-thought-out social design, must recognize that we have different needs and we cannot, nor should we aspire to maximize one of them, but the starting point of our discussion has to be the assumption that both liberty and the common good are essential values to which our society should respond. And instead of trying to maximize one of them, we should make a beginning of our assignment to find ways to see how we can combine them together with minimizing the conflict among them. That is my assignment for tonight. Now, once you start thinking this way, you start asking questions such as, how can we cherish the environment without unduly interfering in people's choices? How can we have a higher degree of public safety without unnecessarily violating people's rights? When you approach the subject that way, looking for ways you can serve both essential societal needs, you sometimes discover that there are some options which can enhance both. And I want to underscore this point because the way I discussed the issue so far leaves the impression that these are right hydraulic relationships, that if you pump up one, you'll have to pump down the other. Or that's what some people would call a zero-sum game. I would like to first of all emphasize that up to a point, it's possible to serve both. So to give you an example, if you would be in the streets of Moscow today, certainly at least some of them, neither social order or liberties are well protected. And if you would move toward a high degree of public safety and a higher degree of community, you would serve both social order and liberty. Those of you who remember Eric Fromm's book, The Escape from Freedom, remember that one of his major arguments was that the Nazism rose in Germany after people were cut off their social mooring and after hyperinflation and a defeat in war, which created this kind of individualization and disassociation of people from their social fabric, leading them open to demagogues. And again, here, if you would have a stronger fabric of voluntary associations, of community bonds, you would have both more of the common good and of liberty. The last example, if you remember the Manhattan studies done by Sorel and others, you find that that reasonable person, that individual who's able to make reasonable choices, which is so much celebrated by the individualist, you find sociologically really exists only within a social fabric. And then when you do isolate people, they have very been isolated, let's say, very often in high-rise buildings in our cities, especially when they get older, you'll find a very high prevalence of a large variety of mental illnesses. So people who are able to reason, who feel confident in themselves, who can make reason choices, often exist within community and not outside it. And here I come to the one piece of jargon I'm going to inflict on you. I don't believe in social science has plenty of verbiage, and I'm reluctant to add one, but I need one. And I want to refer to the ultimate relationship between liberty and the common good as one of inverting symbiosis. And what I mean by that is, up to a point, they enrich one another, as in the example I just gave. And if you push them farther beyond that point, they start to become adversarials. There are actually very few relationships like this. Usually, when you add things, they either pile up. So if you add gifts to loans in some developing country, you have more. Some things are antithetical, like alkynes and acids. Some things enrich one another. There are actually very few relationships which up to a point they go together and then just kind of feed on one another. Since it's so important, let me give it quickly an example from another area. And that is, if you think about the relationship, I understand some of you are interested in education, between control or authority and self-control. Up to a point, they go hand in hand. If you want to educate children and you want to help them to acquire self-control, you need a structured environment. You need a measure of authority and control. If you keep heightening authority, there'll come a point it will destroy your opportunity to enable people to develop self-control. And if we don't realize that, we get into these silly arguments where the people who are gung-ho and self-control start arguing against authority, and people who are gung-ho and authority argue against self-control, not realizing it makes all the difference in the world what part of the continuum you are. Are you in the mutually enriching one, or are you in the adversarial area? And that takes me to my next point, and easily the most controversial. And if I asked you earlier for your indulgence and patience, now comes pay time. I'd like to suggest to you that the best way to enhance the area in which liberty and the common good enrich each other, expand that zone, and reduce the area in which they fight each other and destroy each other, is for the society to rely neither on the market nor the state, but on the community and its moral voice. Now, let me be precise here. All said and done, there are really only three ways to order society, to motivate people to do what we think needs to be done. One is to force them. That's what the state is very good at, especially when its laws do not have moral backing. The other is to pay them. And I'm not talking about work now, I'm talking about the social. In Germany now, where people get discharged earlier from the hospital, as it's happening in many countries, if their friends come over and help them, they get paid. And if children don't put their parents into nursing homes, they get paid. In the United States, there was a suggestion to pay every child $2 for every book they read, and pay teenagers if they don't get pregnant for a year. Now, you see behind a certain kind of thinking. When you use one of these two means, when you use either coercion or pay people to be virtuous, what you get? If you force them, they will sometimes do what you want, but they'll resent it, and they will use every opportunity to get out from under. If you pay them, they will do what you want, but their heart will not be in it. If children will read books because they want the $2, not because they find the book intriguing or compelling, they will read the most superficial reading they can get away with, and you'll have to have supervisors to check on them. Indeed, aside from the fact that if you do it that way, the relationships you build are troubling. There is another catch, and that is there are billions of transactions in the body society every day. I'm not just talking about in the marketplace, but neighbors dealing with neighbors, parents dealing with children, and so on and so on. If you really wanted to rely on either coercion or incentives to order society, you'd either need, and that Plato already made that point, you would either need half the society to be cops and auditors and inspectors. And then, of course, somebody would need to watch these people. As we say sometimes in the United States, half the Americans would have to be cops, and then we would need to bring the Canadians to watch the American cops, you know, and then, I guess, bring you to watch the Canadians. So it's kind of ad absurdum. Who will guard the guardians is the issue. If you pay people to do their social duties, you come into this problem that we already have extremely high level of taxation, not objectively necessarily, but in the eyes of the population. And just adding to them ever more economic burden, it becomes at least politically impractical. But there is a third way. And that is, if you can convince people, what some people call culture, but I've changed the culture. I'm not talking about music and arts. I'm talking about, let's call it by its right name, our values, our moral commitment. When people accept those, then they change their preferences. Now they do want to do what needs doing. So, for instance, we rely, well, if you had more time, I would ask you how much of the firefighting in the United States you think is done by volunteers, including the big cities. And the answer is, at least to me, somewhat surprising, 75.2%. Three quarter of all our firefighting is done by volunteers. The real point behind that is a different one. Is when I saw myself, and when we study young people who do that, they do not see this as an imposition. They do not see this as a state requirement. They don't see, they would be offended if you offered them money. They're proud and enjoy profoundly, not in the same, enjoy is a very tricky word here. It's not enjoying the fair, you enjoy a good steak or all in the hay. It's enjoy in the sense of having the feeling that you lived up to a commitment, that you did something noble. You look at your lifeboats. You look at people who do things for the environment. You'll see all over the place people who do things for one another, for the community, for a common good, as long as they're convinced that this is what needs doing. So the more we can get people to accept what needs doing because they're compelled, in this moral sense, the more we reduce the tension between order and liberty. Now, to get there, we need one more step. We come to the question, how can a society of a complexity of our size, 260 million Americans, how can they come to a shared moral understanding? How can they agree on a new direction? Now, some people find it inconceivable. They're also, in addition, afraid. And there is a reason to be afraid that if we engage in moral dialogues, if we have to talk to each other about values, we're going to get into fights. And the term culture wars is precisely the term used to alert us to the danger which we face when we openly lay our values in the open and try to engage each other to try to reach shared understandings. Cultural wars historically often led to civil wars, and that's the reason they are troublesome and worrisome. So the people shy away from that, especially the individualist camp, argue the following, Habermas, for instance, Bruce Ackerman, that what we should do is bracket our values. We should hold them in abeyance. We should not put them on the table. And instead, we should have reasoned dialogues, deliberation, And they mean something in which we're going to focus on the facts of the situation, on the logical implication, but will not bring to bear our most profound values. Now, it's my argument, and by the way, some of you still have to write a paper, or somebody want another interesting topic for study, that this is impossible. Charles Lindblom has written a lot about it. I did some. If you really look at the situation, you'll find that values and facts are profoundly interspersed. It's impossible, even if it would be desirable, to separate them in that particular manner. Let me just give you one example. I'm sure you heard plenty in this country, as we heard even probably more, about the evils of the deficit and all the implications. In effect, when the history of the Clinton administration will be written, probably most people will agree that the fear of the deficit and serving this particular god played a higher role than most other considerations. Well, those of you who technically follow this argument know that it would be rather difficult to make a technical case for reaching zero deficit. An argument probably can be made that you don't want it to grow as a proportion of the GNP. But for instance, in the United States, we have a deficit which is falling in terms of proportion of GNP, but we are adamant to bring it to zero because it has some kind of symbolic, political, normative meaning. Because in the United States, the deficits have been defined as immoral, as an attack on our children, as depriving future generations. And anybody who speaks up and says that we should have other purposes is immediately charged as if they are insensitive to major moral considerations. I could give you many more examples, a discussion about the environment, and not to mention about abortion. It's not our affirmative action. All these issues are laden with values, and there is no way we can come to shared understandings unless we allow and nourish moral dialogue. So I'm going to contrast the notion of the reason and deliberation, which, if you could get them, have their own merits, with the notion of moral dialogues in which we deliberately and openly engage each other's values, trying to find shared understandings. Now, in order for them not to slip into cultural wars, which they are prone to do, both Jim Hunter and I developed a set of rules of engagement which tell us what we can do in order to prevent us from slipping across that border. They're not perfect, but they usually allow us to stay on track. Now, I don't have the time to go into them, but just illustrate one example. The social understanding that you should not demonize the other side and that you get penalized in the court of public opinion when you do that is an example of how you keep discussion civil. The change in the parliament recently from this viewpoint is a kind of nice illustration how you can, under certain conditions, keep civility at a higher level. In our Senate, it's very unaccepted that you attack another person. You can attack the ideas, but if you say something critical of another senator, you will be asked to apologize. There are many other mechanisms which try to keep things on track. One of the most interesting ones is not to bring up every bad thing you can find in the other person's history. So fact is that we can find dark moments in everybody's history, and if you keep bringing them up, you push the hot buttons in everybody's social and historical conscience. This becomes a major reason we cannot have a good moral dialogue. Now, that may sound all of like a lot of abstractions. Now, so let me give you some concrete examples, and there are lots of them, where moral dialogues on a societal level, which look meandering and messy and complicated and never have a clear ending and not even a clear beginning, do over time lead to major new shared moral understandings and new directions. 1950s, early 60s in the United States. The environment was not on the books. It was not on the map. I mean, I'm not claiming there was not a single professor who may have written some book about it. But on the societal map, it was not a play at all. I mean, people would dump things into the water and into the air without considering it an issue. Then came this very important detail. Rachel Carlson has a book called Silent Spring, in which she made the first case. It often starts with an intellectual making a case. It was then taken to stage two in order to feed these things into a national conversation, a society-wide conversation. You need to take them off the books into the street, so to speak. And there were demonstrations. There was an oil spill in Santa Barbara. They buried a car alive, I mean, a new car. There were all kind of actions. And it followed this billion-hour buzz of people in meetings, on television, radio call-in shows, at the water cooler, in the pubs, argued about what we owe Mother Earth. And out of that came a profound change in direction. Today, we still argue, but we argue at the margins. There's a debate going on how many jobs we should sacrifice for spotted owls. And there are some Americans, quite a few, who feel we didn't do enough, and some others who feel we should have done much more. But I cannot find a single American who will say we should go back to the 1950s. There is a new moral commitment to the environment. If you look at the civil rights debate, and again, obviously you all remember in the 1950s, legal segregation, black Americans in the back of the bus, and all those horrible things, water fountains marked colored and such. Out of that came a public debate. It was triggered through the same mechanism I just described, demonstration, strikes, sit-ins and such. It forced the societal attention on that. There was a profound, painful, difficult moral dialogue, far from over. We changed, certainly not enough by my accounts, some people feel too much, but we changed direction. We have now 2,000 police chiefs who are black, we have blacks who are the head of major cities. By far not enough, but certainly nobody would, in their right mind will talk about going back to the 1950s or that no changes took place. Let me give you some more recent examples. We had, I don't know how many of you followed that, something called the Thomas Hill hearings. What happened, Mr. Thomas was nominated for Supreme Court judge, and Professor Hill charged him with sexual harassment. And this was, for 2 weeks, a hearing which had everybody watching television. Now, frankly, as I see it, for these two individuals, this was a very tragic period. It really basically destroyed them both, damaged them both. For the American society, it was a wonderful exercise. Suddenly, frankly, a lot of males who never took this issue serious were made to face this issue. And we got a significant, far from enough, change in the way we do these things. I don't think today you'll find many places where an employer would dare ask an employee for sex in order to give her a raise or a professor for an A, though things do happen. But our understanding what's right has changed, and our law has changed. I could spend here the rest of the evening giving you one example after the other, and I'm sure you can think about ones here where these moral dialogues take place, and they lead to change in direction. The crucial point is that when we then change, two things happen. We then can legislate based on this moral backing, so the law becomes the continuity of morality by other means, and we make people make many of the changes that need to be made without involving the state. Two quick examples. Unlike you, we had a 25-year debate about smoking. And very recently, we reached a new shared understanding. By the way, the turning point came once it was clear that smoke has secondary effects. It not only damages you, but damages the other person. Out of this road, a very broad understanding that we're going to outlaw smoking in most public spaces. One of the interesting things, I'm sure those of you who visited the United States have seen, that this is self-enforcing. I've been in all my travel, not a single time was in a restaurant or train or airplane where somebody said, he's smoking, let's call the police, or let's throw him out, and so on and so on. At most, staring at the person about all it takes. It's just not done anymore. We are now moving into another area where the same thing is happening. We used to have a saying, have one for the road. That means have a drink before you hit the road. For the last 10 years, I not only didn't hear it, but I'm absolutely sure that if anybody would be so uncouth, so uninformed, so out of it, just woke up from 20 years sleep and said to somebody, have one for the road in any social environment I recognize, they either scratch his eyes out or stare at him in such a way, like, you know. So what happened here? We came together to understand that driving and drinking is something we don't want to mix. Now, given that consensus, then we can pass laws. But it's very different from the prohibition, in which we pass laws without such backing. Just to drive that last point in, let me close this particular point by giving you one very vivid example. We have a place in which we keep people locked up 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. We surround them with barbed wires and machine guns. We call them prisons. And we are unable to stop drug dealing in the prisons. Not just consuming, dealing. Obviously, there is no way we could surround the society with machine guns and guard towers. So when we do not have a profound commitment, the law works very, very poorly. Let me close here by saying then this point, that there is a tension between the common good and liberty. There are areas in which we can enhance both. And there are areas in which the more we can rely on our mutual convictions, based on our community, based on moral dialogues, the more we can have a society, we can advance both. Now, I promise to say a word what all this may mean for what may happen next. As I see it, Blair government will need to deepen and broaden its mandate by triggering and nourishing several moral dialogues. Now, one may wonder here, and one may say, given his tremendous victory in the polls, given his enormous majority, given that your prime minister can do so many more things than our president, why do we need additional moral dialogues? And to be fair, in some areas, it's quite unnecessary. I believe there was a fairly detailed dialogue about devolution, and there seems to be, at least according to public opinion polls, a fair measure of shared understanding. There may or may not, I'm not sure about that, be a fairly coming together on the question if there should be a written constitution or not. But let's take the question of the relationship to Europe. Surely there was a conversation, but a conversation, in my judgment, has not matured to the point that if tomorrow, by force or by passing a vote in Parliament, a major change of direction would occur, that the British society would be ready to underpin and support that change. There are other areas in which, as far as I can tell, the National Health Service and such, where the moral dialogues have not matured. Now, I understand that there are two things already under consideration which are very interesting tools for nourishing moral dialogues. One is, I understand, that there's a consideration of to conduct referenda on specific issues. Now, those of you who are political scientists or follow political theory, referenda are not very warmly regarded by most political scientists. They are dependent very much on the wording, and so they often will lead to a result which does not really reflect the preference of the people, but the way they were worded. They don't allow for compromises. You vote it up or down, and the circuit, they cut around the elected officials, and the famous point Edmund Burke made, that they're supposed to get a mandate and then work with each other rather than vote things up and down. Also, when you do what we go crazy, as we sometimes do in California, And we had 206 of them in 1 year, you know. Nobody knew anymore what was up and down. But if you have them once every 6 months, one, and if they are wonderful tools to focus a public debate. And again, I don't have time to go into examples, but they can be used in that way. And the same holds for select committees. If there are hearings, the way we have them, the way we had in Thomas Hill hearings, you can bring new issues to the surface, you can trigger a national-wide conversation, which will be messy and complicated, but in the end can lead to new shared understandings. But it's not the job of the Prime Minister or politician in general to trigger these conversations. It's the job of intellectuals and opinion makers to lead the way. They have to be the first to make these things, feed these things into body society, and then if there's enough of a beginning or a priming of a conversation, they can be lifted to the next level. Let me say just in closing that having met Mr. Blair and having spent now here in the London School of Economics almost 2 weeks, I'm very confident that you will have the kind of moral conversation which are needed and that many of you will contribute to make them all they can be. Thank you very much.
I understand. I just briefly repeat the question for those of you who couldn't hear it. Of course, we'll not do full justice to all the complexities of the question, but I'll try. And the question basically was raised that should we really leave it to the opinion makers and intellectuals to trigger the conversation, or should we directly address the legislators and also rely on them to spearhead the kind of changes we need? An example was given of Mrs. Thatcher, After all, she set the tone, it was said, for much of it that followed. Now, I would suggest to you, first of all, empirically, that Mrs. Thatcher was following a long line of intellectuals and opinion makers who saw the body society and the Milton Friedman of the world, that kind of thinking. So it's not like she came to a bunch of communitarians or religious fundamentalists or people who were deeply, profoundly committed to a different philosophy of society and gave a speech and made them into free market nuts. There have been a very long tradition of laying the ground for that, and she very much built and latched onto this. As you all know, this line that society is a fiction is not entirely either. There's a famous social philosopher on these shores who preceded that line. Now, I don't dispense with it. Now, I don't suggest at all that we should not talk truth to power, that we should not make our moral arguments only also to public leaders. But there is something which is very easy to understand, but also you'll see tricky. And I like to emphasize this point. There is, when you were 18 years out of power, an appetite to legislate and to pass decrees and do things that way. And it's wonderful if you agree with the values reflected in those actions. And there's a danger you get carried away. And all you have to think for a moment, what will happen if the same tools will be used to things you violently disagree with. And so if you care about animal rights, if a position will be taken against animal rights, or you just imagine any one thing which profoundly offends you, and then you suddenly realize why our societies are built, and I'm not talking about the government, between the government and the body society, with a careful set of check and balances. Now, luckily, in some ways, there is a lot of consensus at the moment on a whole bunch of things, because much of what happened to society precisely deviated from where the shared moral understandings were. And it's, for instance, take the water issue. It's relatively easy to come and say, that's what needs to be done, and nobody, obviously at the margin, somebody's going to bitch. But basically, there's going to be a cheer, and this is wonderful honeymoon now. But I made a flat prediction, and it's a social science that's taking somewhat of a risk. If one simply goes on and legislates and passes decrees one after the other, and especially on issues which are controversial, such as, and again come back to, an issue which is very difficult, profound, emotional and value issues involved, is how deeply one gets into bed with Europe. And you suddenly read about that a decree passing, you'll see why it's essential at the same time to also nourish the moral dialogues. So if the society and the government will meet when it comes to take these actions. Thank you. Again, just briefly to repeat the question, not all of it. The question was asked why we don't apply some of these communitarian ideas more extensively or haven't yet so far to the workplace. And again, it's helpful to remind where we came into the conversation. We came into the conversation basically against the fundamentalist right. And we argued that what they are trying to do is impose virtues. They want to outlaw divorce. They want to mandate prayer. They want to ban homosexual activities. And that we argue that we do need to worry about morals and social virtues. These are not dirty words, but we don't want them to be imposed by any one group on the society. but we want them to arise out of the kind of shared moral understanding, profoundly democratic. And therefore, for instance, our focus was on the family, about what you teach in schools, about what we ought to each other as neighbors. So we came from the social side, and we haven't turned, as you correctly say, to the workplace. Now, as we're now doing exactly that, we're running into serious intellectual challenges, and that's why I said in all seriousness that you're all welcome to participate. And I was delighted to visit some of David Marks' classes and students, and I see there's a lot of discussion on this issue. Now, what will make the corporation into a community, and under what condition the corporation and the community can have a mutually rewarding relationship, I don't have the answer for. Now, a glimpse of a suggestion which is intends a very profound change is the notion which Tony Blair raised very briefly during the election, and then, in my judgment, wisely dropped it, and that was the idea of stakeholder. By the way, the digression, he was very careful to say that he will not want to legislate it, that he will want to have a change in ethos out of which a new understanding will arise that that's the world we should move toward. Now, it raises a whole bunch of moral issues: who owns the corporation, what's the relationship of labor to the corporation, what's the relationship of the community if it invests in it, what's the relationship of the creditors, all the customers, all these. Who has a claim is the issue. I'm not talking about stakeholder as a pragmatic issue, but as a social moral issue. And then there is the question of representation. What does it mean for these other stakeholders to have a say? I must tell you, though, just in terms of making it a little less forbidding than it may seem, I paid for my sins by teaching ethics 2 years at the Harvard Business School. And as some of you may have noticed, I was less than completely successful. And I was very, very surprised to meet some of the top CEOs of the major corporations in the United States and finding them surprisingly interested in the stakeholder theory, which I thought would drive them up the wall. And the reason is that they don't like the idea that it's supposed to be the hired hands of the shareholders, that the other people own the corporation and they're just their servants. Once they are facing a variety of stakeholders, they become kind of, in effect, the politicians of the corporation who are balancing the various claimants, and as a result, have a more legitimacy and somewhat of a role. So that is one direction we may need to move. But let me say that there's a bigger question, which I'll be the first to admit, I don't begin to know what to do about that. And that's the tension between globalization and a civil society. And Ralph Dondorf and recently George Soros and many others on door here have begun to grapple with this issue. And you hear like these two conflicting voices. On the one hand, people say these global forces wash over our shores, they destroy everything we believe in, and we can't allow them to do this to us. On the other hand, people say, but if you're not going to compete, you're going to be out of the business in the first place. And it's very, very much like a startup. These are very incompatible demands. And the question, in effect, many of our societies face, Germany, France, and so on, is how to do that without giving the lapins of the world majorities. Look at Austria, look at other countries. You see the danger of simply opening yourself to the global forces. So the issue you raise has to be not only faced in each corporation singly, but in terms of the relationship between the local society and the global economy. And I would close here by saying that I would not know how to solve the stakeholder issue for individual corporations unless we solve the question how our society relates to the global economy. Because things you would do on the single corporation would depend on you at least finding a handle on that other issue.
Unitarian movement relates to the force of the right in this country in some sense, ideologically. sole preoccupation in the sense that something you would like to see, or you would like to demonstrate a broad dialogue with all sorts of different perspectives?
Again, to truncate the very interesting, challenging comment, the question is if we are, put it again in very simple terms, if we're in a bed with the left, I would like to sleep around a little more. I mean, would we like to have a broader political appeal than just this, building an alliance with one group? I basically see the communitarians as a new environmental movement, which the other one is mainly interested in nature. We are mainly concerned about the body society. And we not only will, we did talk to everybody who will listen. And people from very different political backgrounds, including here, have embraced in one extent or another the communitarian agenda. And it's true that Mr. Blair and some others in the New Labour Party found it of some interest. But I should say I met with nine Tory MPs and had a long conversation with David Willetts. And he understands this issue and speaks to it in his book, Modern Conservatism, about as well as anybody I know. And when I met with Paddy Asherton, he in effect wrote the book about it. His book about community kind of preceded us all and kind of redundant for him. And so it's by no means an issue which is a monopoly of anyone. I could go on citing names. In Germany, Rudolf Scharping, who was the head of the Social Democrats, wrote a paper in which he argued that the Social Democrats should have met us half the way and that they suffered because they didn't pick up the communitarian theme. But at the same time, one of the leading CDU governors, Kurt Biedenkopf, is a very strong champion of communitarian thinking. And the head of the Greens, Joschka Fischer, was our major sponsor of our best meeting in Bonn. So I could go on. But we are talking to all, not only formally, but specifically, and different people pick up different pieces of it, very much the way people relate to the environmental movement. Sure, at one point or another, one of the parties is closer to us, but we are very nonpartisan. Last year, we had Bill Bennett and the president participating in our meeting on education. The year after that, we had the First Lady and two of the Republican senators. So we will engage in dialogue with one and all.
But the things you have mentioned, like the environment or the other cases, seem to be cases where you can put up a sign, don't throw things into the river, don't smoke, and so on and so forth. And it seems to me that many of the cases you mentioned actually relate to specific court cases in the United States, or at least to areas where individuals found that the law gave them a resort against evils that they perceived in society. What I wonder, though, is where does the substance of society grow? I mean, how do communitarian ideas address questions like positive ideas, like don't take drugs because it's bad for you? And what exactly do you think your ideas can work? Or how do they work at that level when it isn't a sign that you can put up or a taboo that you can actually create?
You see, I wish we had another hour just on this one question, because that's the crux of it. Though I don't think this is an issue of legislation, I would argue in all seriousness, and I mean this not technically, that 80% of what we do is regulated by our mutual moral expectations. So when you come to the question, and again, I know all the counter-arguments, why parents take care of their children? There's a law. The law plays a very small role in it, and it's basically an expression of values we have. Because we feel we have a moral commitment. And people who don't feel it don't. Let me give you an extreme example. I did a study and looked at other studies of what happened when somebody has Alzheimer's disease. What happens to their spouse? Now, as you know, it's a horrible disease where the people slowly lose their mind, become abusive. So the question is, why do partly all, there are exceptions, the spouses of people who have Alzheimer's disease stay with them and nourish them, and nurse them for years and years and years, despite the fact that, A, there is no chance to serve you back. There's not an exchange. I'll take care of your cancer, and then you take care of my cancer. This is a fatal disease, going to get worse and worse, the person's going to die, you're going to get nothing back. Second, there's no, this what, when economists face this kind of explanation, they fall back on psychic income. So you're not going to get an exchange, he's not going to take care of you, but instead he's going to give you a reward for appreciating what you do for them. Never an Alzheimer's. They are become disoriented, they don't recognize you, and they become hostile. So why do people do that? And when you ask them, there's some people say they do it for their neighbors. Anybody spend one day with an Alzheimer's patient, they'll say all the neighbors fly a kite. They take a walk. The reason is they feel morally compelled. They feel it's the right thing to do. People vote for taxes on cigarettes who are smokers. Lots of them. If you look at Paul Stern's book about the issue you raised, about what makes people better environmentalists in their practices, it's only if they believe that something a decent human being does. All the others, I shouldn't say only, mainly, all the others secondary. So the changes I'm talking about, if they're positive or negative, this is often just different phrasing, they all arise out of, because the community changes expectations. Look at what happened to the gay community in terms of dangerous behavior. When we come together and encourage each other to be nobler than we would be otherwise, we change our behavior because we feel inside we should act differently, and because our friends, our families, our neighbors, those we care most about, appreciate when we do what's right and chide us when we don't, like the example of drinking. The laws are secondary, treasury. I know it's difficult to get handle of because it's so used to, legislation is so visible, you can measure it, you can taste it, you can read it. And this culture, the social fabric, is really not as visible, it's not on the sign. But do an empirical study and you see that it is governing both our social life and in the end our laws. The question has, I talked about volunteers who feel nobler for it. What about when people volunteer because they feel guilty? And isn't guilt a form of coercion? Excellent question. You may want to know you have John Stuart Mill on your side at least half the time when he talks about coercion by the government and by public opinion. And it's the number one debate these days, if you look at Weekly Standard, which is one of our conservative magazines, between the extreme libertarians and the moderate libertarians. Let me grant you that when people do things of the kind I just described, they don't do it only because they woke up on Monday morning and said, you know what, I feel like volunteering for firefighting today. Where's the place? They may be encouraged by their friends. They may be chided if they don't. Just go back to a very simple example to save time. When I was at the Harvard Business School, once a year they all went and did something for the poor. It was an outreach day. They whitewashed some fences. And if you did it, and if you didn't show, people looked at you awkwardly and, you know, you may made you skip a cocktail party. Now, the question is though, is there a profound difference between encouraging people and chiding them, criticizing them, and making them feel guilty when they don't do what socially, and between coercion? And there's a very profound difference. And the profound difference is that when I coerce you, you have no choice left. I'll take you by the scrape of your neck, and I'll throw you into concentration camp, or into jail, or I'll tow your car, I'll make you. When I appeal to your conscience, when I appeal to your guilt, in the end, you make the decision. in the end, you make the choice. It's impossible, impossible for society to rely only on people waking up and finding goodness in their own heart. Societies are built on us encouraging each other through these non-coercive means.
Thank you. There will be another opportunity to continue this conversation with Professor Etzioni in the new theatre on the 9th of June. You have details of this on the yellow sheets on the film. You're all very welcome to come to that in 10 days' time. There's also an opportunity to continue in formal discussion now. I can invite you to have one for the road in the knowledge that no one here can afford Central London parking prices. They're all on public transport. Upstairs on the 5th floor, there will be a reception. I'll ask you very much to join us. But before that, you may ask me to thank Mr. It's, I think, wonderful in the place that fostered Richard Titmuss and the writing of the book, The Gift Relationship, which was rather rude about Americans, humanitarians, that we have had an example tonight of American firemen when they've been shooting on the other foot, British appear to come out as well. It's one of many insights in what was a fruitful and creative